Welcome to the Critical Futures Podcast. It's critical because the time is now to conjure the world and communities we want to live and thrive in. But it's also futurity, or the intentional imagining and materializing of liberated futures, where freedom from oppression, trauma, violence, and discrimination are realized. In this series, The Future Of, we chat with experts in various sectors to learn about what they are doing to shift the critical now for a radical new future. I am Dr. Amber Johnson, and I will be your host for this episode. Welcome. On today's episode, we are joined by the executive director of the Diaspora DNA Story Center, Monica O. Montgomery, to talk about the future of the unmuseum, or what it means to rethink and reshape museums to be spaces where visitors actively participate in the creation of our art, our stories, and our histories. Monica O. Montgomery, I am so glad you are here. Let's start with inspiration. You've served in so many important roles. You've been an administrator, a co-founder, an organizer, a literal trailblazer, and so many other titles within the museum sector. So what inspired you to embark on this particular journey to create this unmuseum, the Diaspora DNA Story Center?
Well, thank you so much for having me on the podcast, Amber. And it's really great to be able to come and share something that is so personal, that I'm incubating, that I'm building, that I'm launching with blood, sweat, and tears. In this wild world, there is still room and need for new movements, new organizations, and new frameworks. So I've been inspired, actually, and fueled by my grief. I am bereaved. And in the last year, I've lost both of my parents almost back to back. And my parents are my greatest inspirations, my greatest role models, and the people that helped shape me and form me into the woman, into the professional that I am today. So in their passing, I rediscovered their passions, and that would be from my father, African-American history, books, and ephemera. He was a collector, an appraiser, a historian, and someone that had so much love for the literary canon of our people and diasporic folks writ large. And my mom being an artist, a love of photography and art and arts education. And so they really left me a large collection of well-worn, loved, archival and antiquarian books and photos and ephemera and all sorts of things that I felt would be a gift to the world, a gift to the city. Not that I should just have a private collection and deluxe apartment in the sky and just sit and enjoy it, but that others could learn from and be inspired by and enriched by. So I am creating an institution fueled by my parents' dream and legacy that everyone can benefit from their collection and the model that they set.
So let's unpack that, because you just dropped so many gems around the responsibility of these institutions to share knowledge, but also just memory, grief, loss. You know, we tend to forget so many things, especially in a culture where social media and advertising and things like Twitter have really shortened our attention span. You're talking about the longevity of a lifespan of memories that even predates the lifespan, right? Because you're talking about these historical artifacts. So talk to me about sort of what cultural experiences that we crave, that we need, but often don't get because of the world we live in, because of how many things are forgotten, but also because of how many things are intentionally erased from our histories.
Definitely. We need, and we, right? That's a loaded term right there. But if I were to say what I need, and people that I know who are like-minded, and maybe people that I don't know who are also like-minded need, space to process. there is a lot happening. There is information overload. There is this weird desire that people crave to always be digitally connected. And oftentimes in the digital and technological connections, there's nothing wrong with that, but we lose the personal connection. And so we need space to process. We need to reintroduce ourselves to each other, to hold space with each other, the spirit of social cohesion, the spirit of togetherness and belonging. I think there is a deep-seated hunger for that and a need for spaces that can bring and create that. We need to tap back into memory, the memories that we have and hold that often we're so busy in this rapid fire, kind of no attention span economy. We're so busy making new memories that we're forgetting what has happened. And then the memories of our ancestors. We need to remember who our ancestors are and what they went through for us to have the luxury and the liberty we have today. We need to honor and, what I like to say, venerate our ancestors. And certainly amongst all of that, we also need whimsy and joy and play and fun. And how can we mix up and mash up and make a salad of all of those energies to create a cultural organization in our image that meets our needs, that brings us closer together as opposed to stratifying us further apart?
So many words said, so many words. So you really are talking about the future of not just museums, not just the future of curating an archive that speaks to history, but really the future of humanity, right? And how do we get back to being the humans who value other humans, who value collective experience and memory, who value truth and honesty? I love that. So as you're curating and compiling this massive wealth of information, this next question is really twofold. How has this process of discovery become your grieving process? We'll start there. I'll ask the second question later because that's enough, right? How has this process really helped you with your grief?
It is. It is. I say this, whether it's healthy or not, I'm sure my therapist might not agree that it is the best way to process, but I feel that my grief is my fuel for building Jasper DNA Story Center, and that some of the best ideas and instincts and some of the revelations, right, are coming from the grief, right? For instance, when my mom passed away and we did her homegoing a few months ago, I grew up in a Baptist church, and we went back to that church to lay her to rest and to celebrate her life. And the pastor, when we met with him before the service, said, "I want you to know we're going to do a processional." And I said, "Oh, what's that?" And he's like, "We're going to process in. We're going to march in as a family." And I'm like, "Wow, that's powerful." Now, again, hearing that before I experienced that, it sounded cool, but it didn't mean much because I don't have much family left. And I knew of the family I had left, even fewer of them were coming. And so I'm like, okay, well, it'll be a small group of us, you know, looking, whatever, holding on to each other, walking in. And so when it was time, the pastor, we were kind of sitting in the pews, just talking and reflecting on memories before the formal service started. And when the formal service started, I asked that they play not a spiritual song, but I guess you call it a secular song, but a beautiful, meaningful song, which is "Someday We'll All Be Free" by Donny Hathaway. And the pastor asked me and my husband and my godmother and cousin who came to line up and get ready to process in. And so literally, you know, the four of us went to line up in the back of the church to walk in behind the pastor. And then I heard like some movement, and I was, again, teary-eyed. I wasn't really paying attention. And I felt someone kind of hold my hand and catch my hand. And then I looked back, and every single person, about 75 people who came to the service, got in line behind us. And the pastor said, "We're all family. We're all Sandra's family, and we're all going to walk in together." So here I was thinking I was performing this procession for those who were seated in there, but they all came and got behind us and held our hand and supported us. And we walked in to Donny Hathaway, "Someday We'll All Be Free." And that, I mean, that right there, I just need to note that. That was a moment in time. That was one of the most beautiful things I ever experienced. And I was like, "Mommy, like, look, everyone is here. Everyone is family in this moment for us, you know?" So I feel that that kind of experience of being held, being supported, being loved, feeling like you have family when you think you don't, I want to bring the beauty and the pathos and the joy and the energy of that to this space, to this Diaspora DNA Story Center space. I want people who are going through a tough time to not feel so alone. I want people who are bereaved and remembering their family or friend or loved one or lover to have affirmation and positivity. I want grief to be the fuel in the best of ways, and to feel that there is a place to bring that. Because oftentimes in society, I've experienced that people are kind of telling you like, "Oh, you know what? You know, buck up. Everything will be okay. Wipe your tears away. You got to move on with your life." People are trying to rush you through what you're feeling and not giving you space to process, right? Space to grieve or space to feel any of the feelings that we might feel. I want people to feel like we are in a procession in front of and behind of and at the sides of each other and holding each other and moving through as one in the spirit of those we love. That meant the world to me, and I want to bring that energy to this space.
I am over here in tears. I got chill bumps, and again, the future of humanity. There is something so beautiful about honoring our loved ones and our ties, whether they be blood or not, in community. And I see what you are doing as an intentional space to do that in community through these artifacts, through these memories. I'll share a quick story. When my mother-in-law passed away in 2022, a couple of months before she passed, she kind of jokingly, and nobody knew she was, you know, it was abrupt. Her passing was very abrupt. She jokingly said to me walking down the hall, "Amber, I don't plan on dying anytime soon, but when I do, I'm leaving you all my clothes." And my mother-in-law at the time was like 5'3", probably 125 pounds. And for those of you who don't know me who are listening to this podcast, I am not 5'3", and I am not 125 pounds. So my immediate response was, "That's so sweet. I probably can't fit anything, but, you know, thanks." But I didn't say that. I just said, you know, "Thank you." And I did not realize how important that gift was until a couple months later she passed. First of all, I did not realize how much clothes this woman had curated in her life. She had 3 bedrooms of clothes. She had a department store worth of clothes. And I'm not just talking about, right. And I'm not just talking about like I went to the sale rack and bought some random stuff. I am talking gorgeous, beautiful designer gowns, fur coats, winter coats, just bad shoes. I can't fit her shoes, unfortunately. But she had all these clothes. And so I was in charge of choosing her homegoing outfit. And so I'm going through all of these clothes. And so I can imagine what you were experiencing as you were just going through all of these artifacts. It really became a place to understand connectivity, you know, the connective tissue that brings us together. So yeah, they're just clothes. They're just, you know, it's just a song. It's just a processional. It's just a this, but it's never just that. It is always something so much bigger. And I found so much meaning and love just going through this woman's clothes and feeling so honored that she would gift something so personal to me, you know? And so thinking about like processing grief, there are so many ways to process grief. And I did not do that alone. I did that with my partner and with his father, with my mother. I had people around me going through these things and just sharing stories and thinking about, you know, the memories that these clothes conjured. And, oh, I remember when she wore this to this event, and look at this picture from this event. And so I imagine that this Diaspora DNA Story Center is going to create that same kind of thing, even amongst strangers. I remember this moment. I had a similar story. And so I'm really excited to hear about how you're thinking through cultivating these feelings, these things that give us chill bumps. But when you're not there necessarily to facilitate that, but how are all these artifacts going to help you bring those things out?
Sure. Well, one other element I want to add to the story I just shared about the processional is that my mom actually went to college with Donny Hathaway to Howard University in D.C. And got to interact with him and enjoy his music. So again, playing Someday We'll All Be Free, the title, the song, the track, the energy, and the personal connection would have meant the world to her. And I just kept thinking like, oh, Mom, I wish you were here to see it. And I'm like, oh, you're here. You see it. You feel it. So you're right. There's layers of meaning and just layers of intimacy in the truest form of the word and all that we do, especially when we grieve. But you were asking about artifacts and art and how these things could be curated. I must say, as you know, with our long history of supporting one another's museum ventures, nothing that I do and bring is going to be predictable, traditional, or status quo. It's just, I don't have it in me, right? So we are really thinking through deeply, myself and my team, my advisors and volunteers, how to append, remix, and freshen the interpretation, which is how things are displayed, explained, positioned, right? I don't want this to be a come, look, and leave, but rather something that really gets to the essence and the nuance of how we can feel connected and find threads and points of resonance in material culture and ephemera in history and art. So for example, this is one of the interpretations we're thinking through. We're still very much in process, but we're practicing with this one. Let's say there's a collection of items that is on a light box table, right? You come into a room, you know, maybe there's some mood lighting. Certainly there's some music because I love a good vibe. But there is a table, when I say a light box, a table that is lit with, you know, frosted glass on it. And there'll literally be a bunch of different items. There can be a record. There could be a book. There could be a photograph. There could be a love letter. There could be a mortgage deed. There might be a map, right? And so we're going to put you with some archival gloves, right? And train you on how to safely and appropriately handle items. And then you'll get a chance to handle them. And there may be some tablets or screens that you can press to get additional information about these items. We're going to ask people, what is the theme or the thread that they think binds these items together? We're looking at universal human themes, be they, you know, travel and migration, achievement, joy, you know, pain, struggle, liberation, resistance, all of these things that come up in a lifetime that can connect items beyond the specific historical dusty dates, which is a term I'm coining, I know, much to the chagrin of my colleagues. But it's more so about like, what is the theme and the energy of these items, and where there is a pattern, we'll highlight that, whether it's in the labels or in the tech. If it's all of these items are about travel and freedom and liberation, right? Maybe there's a Negro Green Book, and maybe there's a song playing about, you know, leaving on a midnight train to Georgia, and maybe the map factors into that. Maybe the books factor into it. Maybe these are photos that were taken on someone's vacation to Chicken Bone Beach back when beaches were segregated, right? Maybe there are things beyond the African-American diaspora that are filtered in from diasporas of the global majority, which is a term that we use, looking at all places where people of color, people who are of melanin reside and what is that common thread. And things will begin to emerge as items are handled, as narratives are shared, as people want to explore more about what connects these items and giving people a chance to learn more. And then folks will get a chance to tap in deeper and select an item that speaks more to them, have a chance to sit with it, learn more about it, but be encouraged to make something. That's when we say, okay, you like the postcards or the photographs of people on vacation. What is this bringing up for you in your life? Share a story, an oral history about a time that you traveled, that you migrated, that you moved from place to place, and what that reminded you of. So in that moment, we want to put the person who is handling items, who is learning about objects or ephemera, in the driver's seat of preserving their history, because we are history in the making. And so they have to share, if they are inclined, a story, an oral history that will then be archived and go into the archives that someone else can listen to. And then they'll have a chance to make art about what they've learned, and that art can then be live curated and put on the wall. So by coming through the space, interacting with the objects and artifacts and ephemera, and then realizing, oh, I need to document my story and witness what I've been through for future generations, that is going to be the process where everyone leaves. You know, you might come a stranger, but you leave a maker, an author, a curator, a historian, and an artist.
I love all of it. I do, especially the invitation, the unmuseum invitation to touch, to feel, to experience, but also to talk and reflect. I think of traditional museums as very quiet, sterile places where you don't touch things. And yes, our work clearly rubs up against that in beautiful ways. But I love the intentionality, you know, to be intentional about shifting away and shifting into something new. I want to switch our conversation. Something that you said really sparked an idea around intangible intergenerational wealth. Oftentimes, when we think about intergenerational wealth, we are thinking about fiscal resources, right? The inheritance of money or property, right? Assets. And I think what you are doing here is really highlighting a different kind of economy that is rooted in ancestry and legacy and things that are truly priceless, invaluable. So what has this process taught you about intangible intergenerational wealth and what it means to honor that which is passed down that might not be considered a particular kind of asset, but lends itself to historical knowledge that otherwise would have been forgotten, right? So how is memory intangible intergenerational wealth?
Yes. I say often that the best thing that my parents ever did was leave me all that they collected in their lifetime. And that was not money. There was not much money to be had after final expenses and bills were paid out, but they left me their literal passion in the form of material culture, books, and objects. And so when we think of intangible intergenerational wealth, what we are left and what we can leave, we are in a generational position now of starting to think about those who are coming behind us, our children, or the folks that we teach, the folks that are in our neighborhoods, those that are being raised up that are often misunderstood in their generation. What can you translate to them that is not a capitalistic asset, right? You can translate or transfer creativity. You can translate and transfer memories. You can translate and transfer esteem and regard, and for them to have a high, healthy self-esteem and a healthy regard for the diasporas that we're coming from. You can translate and transfer all that you've learned in your lifetime, be that learning lessons about, you know, the school of hard knocks, the rough parts of life, or any sort of intellectual pursuits and subject matter expertise. There's a lot we can share, a lot we can learn, a lot that we can celebrate that goes beyond money and capital. And that is part of the work that we're here to elevate.
Thank you for that reframe and for that, the gems, all the gems. So it sounds like this process is really a tribute and honorary to our ancestors. Can you talk to me about ancestral veneration and the importance of lineage?
Sure. Well, I'm on a very deep learning journey about ancestral veneration. It's not a new term, and it's a term that I've been introduced to by some of my colleagues and friends that practice African traditional spiritual practices. And others, right? I think the common notion of an altar hints at ancestral veneration. What is the physicality and the memories that we have about our ancestors so that their essence never dies, right? So whether that is the fact that I now have my parents' wedding picture sitting on my night table, that every time I go to sleep and when I wake up, that's the first thing I see. That's how I like to remember them, united and young and in love and idealistic as they were. And so that has become a kind of altar. I've added other pictures to that altar. I've added other things. I start wearing my father's college ring. He went to Harvard University, class of 1968. Now I wear his ring and people always say, oh, you went to Harvard. No, I did not. But my ancestor did. And I'm honoring that. And he was the first in our family to go to an institution of an Ivy League. And that was a big deal, but he paved the way for others who wanted to go in that direction. And so that's a way of honoring him and his legacy and his sacrifice. So I think veneration, uplifting, honoring, amplifying, remembering, those terms could all be used synonymously. But what do we do to remember? And the memory doesn't always have to be sad. You know, there are times that I cry and then there are times I laugh. There's times that I feel my mother or father's presence or feel that they have led someone to cross my path. There's times that I sit on my balcony and I look out at the nature and literally I see the wind moving through the trees and I feel my parents presence and I say, thank you, Mom. Thank you, Dad, for this breeze. Thank you for this sunshine. Thank you for reminding me whose I am and whom I am. Thank you for this Montgomery last name. So I think it's all about crafting a kind of legacy of love, but ultimately taking the posture of honor and upliftment and never forgetting who you are and who your ancestors are for you.
Thank you for this breeze. Thank you for this sunshine. Thank you for this name. Oof. You said a legacy of love. Let's talk about legacy. How do you define legacy? And what do we owe preceding and future generations when it comes to legacy?
You know, there's that, the Jay-Z song, and he's like, legacy, legacy, legacy. I just like saying that part of the song, not endorsing him in any way. But I think that, you know, to me, legacy is like, what is the mark that you are leaving on people? On spaces, on the world, and how is that felt once you're no longer there? So you could do a lot of busy work, right? Or a lot of, you know, racking up awards or achievements or degrees or any sort of, you know, commodification of things. You could do a lot in your lifetime, but what is remembered? What's the mark that you leave when you're no longer there? And again, on people, because again, this is a world of people. Institutions are just collections of people trying to do the best they can with assets, right? So what is the mark you leave on people? What's the mark you leave on space? And then at the real highest level, what mark can you leave on the world? I am obsessed with the notion of legacy. I'm obsessed with the notion of memory. And a lot of this is stemming from my parents, both of whom fell ill with a variety of comorbidities, but most notably, they both had Alzheimer's and dementia. My mom had Lewy body dementia, as well as the traditional dementia, and my dad had the traditional dementia. And so seeing such two bright scholars who taught me everything, who I thought were the smartest people in the world, succumb to the ravages of dementia, where you don't just lose a few memories. You lose eventually all memory, knowledge of sometimes who you are, who your loved ones are. And in the case of Lewy body dementia, your body starts to break down normal functions, right? You forget how to swallow. You stop breathing as well. Your metabolism and all those things shut down. And so you're seeing someone lose themselves and be lost. And so I think for me, since memory and memory loss brings so much pain to my life, that is another source of fuel. I try to use my pain and my grief as fuel, that even if it is my genetic legacy on both sides of my family, that they have forgotten, right? That I might one day forget. I want to leave a legacy in the world that cannot be forgotten, that our mark will be made on people, on space, and on the world writ large.
I love it. I love it. I love listening to you talk. My definition of legacy is not dissimilar to yours. It is what people say about you when you're not in the room, and where people can go because they shared a room with you.
Mm.
And I define legacy this way because I think we often think about legacy as the thing you leave behind. But I also think it's the thing that you build, right, while you're here. Because the notion of leaving something behind means that you've done the work to leave something, right? Like, so what are we doing now so that when we do leave this plane, there is something left behind? And I feel like your definition and mine both have these tenets that are teetering on memory. Because again, if someone's talking about you when you're not in the room, they're speaking of a memory. When you pass, you're as people speak of you at your funeral, or, you know, just remembering who you were, those are all memories. So when we think about Black and brown people and this notion that, you know, we struggle is kind of our birthright. We are expected to struggle. We are expected to struggle to not struggle too, right? In terms of fighting the struggle, that it comes sort of as our life duty. So I want you to reflect on this idea of what does it take to even be remembered? Who should be remembered? And how is that connected to this notion of Black and brown labor?
Sure. I'm going to say something a little counter to what you said, just because I am hope springs eternal, for better or for worse. So I'd like to say that art and culture is our birthright, and that even if we have been born into legacies of struggle, that we don't deserve that, that we shouldn't stay stuck there, and that we have to reclaim the honor, the dignity, and the royalty in the term birthright. We cannot swim in the waters of permanent despair. We have to find ways up out of that, and to get back on the playing field, right, of creativity and dignity. So I want to just leave that for us to chew on. Your question, though, about what does it take to be remembered? I think people tend to remember folks who are outstanding. Certainly, they tend to remember folks who are charismatic. But ultimately, you're remembering someone for how they impacted you and potentially others that you know. Some people are remembered for who they hurt, right? These despots and villains and dictators and mass murderers and those kinds of folks that leave that legacy are reviled and remembered in bad ways. Some people are remembered for who they helped, or they remembered for the beauty that they brought to the world, or the innovation, the inventions. Some people make processes and systems easier or illuminate new truths in our human condition. And so there's all these different ways of being remembered. I guess who should be remembered is up to the individual. I tend to look highly upon and remember people who are helpers, who are lovers, who are freedom fighters, who are activists, who resist status quos and systems of oppression, because that is how I am oriented. There are some people that are fascinated by, you know, celebrities and rich people. And while I think that's kind of shallow, I understand, right? What is the allure of that? You're excited that someone else has money and power or beauty, probably because that person wants the same. And so they're standing out in their mind and remembering those kinds of folks in that way. But I think those that should be remembered are those that improve the human condition, improve their immediate community around them, show love, respect, and regard in their everyday walk, famous or not, and do something for others.
So I want to be real clear. I 1000% agree with you. And sorry that I wasn't super clear in the formation of that question. I think that we are taught that our birthright is to struggle, that we are supposed to struggle. And if we're not struggling, we're doing something wrong. But I do think our birthright is joy. It's pleasure. It's breathing. You know, it's being human. It's being wholly and fully ourselves.
Yeah.
But I think so often, because we're taught that we must struggle, we often forget to live, to breathe, to be happy, and there's a guilt associated too, right? With experiencing that unfiltered joy. I remember distinctly when Popeyes came out with that chicken sandwich and folks were lined up to get that chicken sandwich. And it was, those lines were places of Black joy, but folks were coming for heads. You know, if y'all showed up to vote the way you showed up to eat that chicken sandwich, maybe we wouldn't be where we are, you know, or folks who qualify for food stamps and welfare, but buy shrimp. It's like, how dare you use that to buy shrimp, as if being poor or low income means you should not have joy. You shouldn't have access to art and music and good food. And so I think that what I also love about your answer is when you're saying who should be remembered. Yeah, you talked about all these people who fought, who are freedom fighters. Folks like Cori Bush will be remembered for a long time. But we also are remembering people who just made you feel good, people who just showed up in their communities and existed, who were models for what it means to breathe and have joy. You know, I think about the folks who we lift up often. There is often this connected story, regardless of what they did with their lives. There's always this connected underpinning of how they made life better for Black folks, for brown folks. And I wonder, in this future that we are creating through these conversations, will there be places for folks to be celebrated because they were just happy, you know, just happy, or just made beautiful music, but didn't have to write about the struggle or sing about the struggle? And I don't know when that will happen or if it will ever happen, but it is definitely something that I look forward to if it is achievable in this lifetime or the next. You know,
yeah.
We struggle so much, but there's so much beauty. There's so much beauty in this world. So much. And when I think about what you're doing with Diaspora DNA Story Center, I feel like what you're doing is creating a space for these sort of everyday lived experiences, whether it be an object or a story, to be untethered from this perpetual struggle and just rooted in humanity, the ebbs and flows of humanity. So I want to get into the Story Center. So let's unpack it. First, let's start with the title, right? The D word, diaspora. Share with me your understanding of the diaspora and how it informs the title of your project, but also the role it plays in your curation and the assemblage of all of these art.
Sure. So the definition I like to use for the term diaspora comes from the Adinkra group, and they actually host repatriation clinics and visits and trips back to Ghana and other parts in continental Africa, oftentimes for African Americans. And they say, a diaspora is a large group of people with a similar heritage or homeland who have since moved out to places all over the world. And so shaping it in that way, in terms of the similar heritage or homeland, the places they've moved, it takes some of the loadedness out of it. I think a lot of times when diaspora is mentioned, it is mentioned through the lens of tragedy, trauma, and injustice, of like, this happened to us and we had to move. We had to flee. We became asylees, refugees. And I certainly don't want to get too deep into all of that because this is not meant to be a geopolitical museum, but rather a museum that celebrates collective memory, shared histories, and human connection. So whatever it is that caused your diaspora to move, there, own that, celebrate that, research more about that. But let's talk about the stories of individuals and the collective and the greater diaspora, and let's bring that to the space in a way that we can build tolerance, learn from, and be affirmed by each other. So I feel that the diasporas that we want to focus on the most are the diasporas of the global majority. That would be the African American, the Latinx, the Afro-Caribbean, the Indigenous, the First Nations, the Southeast Asian, and all other types of folks who identify as global majority folks or people of the sun or melanated people, realizing that everybody comes from a diaspora and everyone has a heritage, and we are by no means shutting out anyone from bringing their diaspora stories to the space. But what the collection will support is those kinds of global majority stories. But there will be space that everyone can pinpoint on a map on the wall where they're coming from, where was their homeland, where have they moved to, where have they moved to recently, have they moved after COVID or moved for work, moved for school, what prompted that. So you will get to make your diaspora linkages in this space, and then the collection items will support global majority diaspora stories. And then one more thing I want to say, in general, I think that, you know, it's beautiful when people can learn about each other's diaspora in a spirit of inclusion and appreciation, right? So learning about the Black diasporic or Latinx diasporic or continental or, you know, mixed heritage diasporic diasporas isn't something that only people from that diaspora might want to learn. Everyone might want to learn about that because these are stories of us all. And we all have these intersections and common threads and shared humanities. So it's not like, oh, you know what? I'm from the Chinese diaspora and I only want to see about my diaspora. Eventually, we might get the technology where you can stratify collections items and call up anything in the collection related to the Chinese diaspora. But in the meantime, we want you to see and learn and touch, taste, and feel all the things about the other diasporas and see how similar they might be to your own. So again, affirming the shared humanity.
I want to thank you for naming what all too often becomes the norm, that the diaspora is this sad, trodden, you know, place of just tragedy. It is not just that. It is so much more than that. And I think you nailed it right there at the end. It's about human connectivity, right? The diaspora is relational. We are connected, and we are connected across all of these great, you know, earthly sectors, planes, resources. And there is power in that connectivity. And I think the second part of your title is really what brings that connectivity together, and that's the storytelling. So why are we putting stories at the center? Talk to me about story center.
Because everyone in the world has a story, or at least knows a story or has heard a story. And by taking this out of the fussy, unaccessible, privileged elitism of museums and museology, which might I add, I have dedicated my career to, so I know it like the back of my hand. But I want this time around for things to be very, very everyday. I want everyday people to come in this space, everyday people to see themselves in this space, everyday people to realize they are making history and their story is worth preserving. So calling it a story center is literally naming what we want the exchange to be. You learn a story, you share a story. You leave a story, you take a story. You hear from storytellers. We will have griots and poets and authors and singers sharing their art. And then we will harken back to the collection and the archive and learn what are the stories that were happening there. My archives manager, literally, every time she's here
I have the archive is between my home office and some of our climate control storage spaces. And every time she's here, I'm going through, there's about maybe 5,000 books, items, ephemera. It's a lot, right? It's a lot. And I'm going through, I'm like, oh, I found a new book. I found a new photo. And let's draw out the story. Tell me the story. Research this item and see what you find. Then I'm going to research and see what I find. And we're always jamming about stories, which is making the process go a little slower than it should. But the beauty of it is we're not just logging things in spreadsheets or touching it with archival gloves, but we're trying to figure out what is interesting, dynamic, unique, special, strange, rare about this item, about this book, about this archive, and how do we tell those stories? So in the future, as we are labeling and archiving things digitally, someone might be able to tap into our technological systems and say, I want to see stories about, you know, love lost. I want to see stories about unemployment. I want to see stories about climate change. And we will have story tagged all of our items in such dynamic and specific ways that anything that relates to those stories will be called up. And again, it's not just about what happened in 1972, but what were the stories this item is telling across the continuum of time? And how do we layer in everyday people's personal story, oral history, and life stories to add to the archive so it grows and it grows?
What a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful just omen to again, human connectivity and stories. It's, you are doing such powerful work. And I just want to take a second to honor what is possible when we slow down. Because stories aren't meant to be fast. They're meant to be, you know, savored. They're meant to be things that you walk and roll through and you really just immerse yourself in. So I just want to name that and just say thank you for taking, like, keep taking your time, Monica O. Montgomery. Take your time. Because when we do, magic happens. And data can only go so far. Quantitative data can only go so far. Stories are such an important piece to understanding history, right? And stories from so many different perspectives. So just honoring that. So the last thing I want you to unpack for us in terms of this title is the unmuseum. So like our listeners should know by now, Monica O. Montgomery is the truth. This is not a person who read one book about museums and decided that she was an expert. This is somebody who has lived and breathed the museum sector since adulthood, period. Like, this is your life.
Yeah.
So talk to me about what it means to intentionally break the rules now that you've learned to live by them for so long with the unmuseum.
Yes. I love breaking rules, especially in professional spaces. And then breaking rules in service of creating new models. That is literally innovation. That's what we all should and could aspire to in our own ways, in our own spaces. I'll also say that I've been at this museum game for quite some time. It's coming up on 15 years. And I started very much humbly, started from the bottom, and now we're here, right? And so I started unpaid, intern, volunteer, overlooked, overwhelmed, underpaid or not paid at all, getting coffee, being ignored, people accusing me of stealing from the gift shop. All kinds of wild, zany things happened in my early career days. And slowly over time, to the point of taking time, learned this field by doing. I already had master's degrees. I already had bachelor's degrees. I didn't want another degree. I wanted to learn this craft by doing and set on a course of self-study and apprenticeship and internships and fellowships and every other kind of ship to deeply immerse myself in the world of museums. And in that process of being a tour guide, being an educator, being someone that planned events and programs, being an executive director, being a co-founder of Museum Hue, being a founder of Museum of Impact, being a core team member of Museum Workers Speak, and all these different advocacy and activism movements that centered around museums and liberation, or museums and abolition, thinking about how I wanted to structure myself and my legacy in these spaces that didn't feel like they affirmed me, that felt confining, restricting. Erasure is a term that comes to mind, often feeling like I could not fit my bold, beautiful dreams in these frameworks. And then I realized it's time to come out of these frameworks. So when this season of grief began and I realized, okay, mom and dad, you've left me something, and it's not just for me, it's for all of us. And similar to Schomburg, right, or all of the other great folks of color who were museum founders who wanted to share their gifts, their treasures, their archive, their philosophies, their history with the world, it was time to create a new frame. And so while I'm deeply immersed in museums and I've been a professor of museums and a Smithsonian curator and all the things, I wanted to do something a little different that would be received and perceived differently, that ultimately could honor us all and honor the thing we have in common, which is our stories. And so I think that this rule breaking is going to yield. It's going to bear fruit. I think that when the Story Center opens, ideally we are wanting to open somewhere, somehow, in the year of 2026, not adverse to opening after that, but we are on track to do something that year. And we have, to our credit, been doing pop-up experiences starting this year, going through till then. We have all sorts of things planned, right? It's not just exhibits in an archive. Literally, we're planning hidden history escape rooms. We're planning ancestor tribute library altar spaces where you can go print on a picture of your loved one who is ill or bereaved or passed on and attach it to a book in a sacred library setting and reflect on them and light a candle and, you know, witness all the other images and love letters that are written on bookmarks, right? We're planning all kinds of interesting things around genealogy and ancestry tracing, because diaspora DNA is meant for part of this to be a experience where people can learn where they come from, learn more about their DNA, their ancestry, and their genealogy. So we're in the process of talking with genealogists to have them on site during open hours so people can do that work. We're thinking about how we can literally have live performing arts every day we're open or every other day. We're thinking about how people need to learn what it takes to write an obituary, having had to write two so suddenly back to back and realizing the obituary is the ultimate form of crafting your life story. Some people write it for their family and some people don't have the chance to, and it is written about them. But what would you write about yourself if you were at the back end of your life? And what would you write about yourself right now? Memoir and obituary writing is an art form. There's so much, right? Time capsules and collage and chill nights and all these things we want to do to be that space for story. So there's a lot being planned. Rule breaking is just the beginning, but it's going to be beautiful and it's going to honor all of our ancestors along the way.
Monica, it is already beautiful. It really is. And I just, I want to say thank you for existing. Thank you for taking shape and form in the ways that you have. And thank you for all the gifts you bring to this museum and unmuseum world. You are a gift and you are someone we all should be just following. And so I just, I am so thankful to be able to call you a colleague, a friend, a mentor. Just, you're an amazing person. And I cannot wait to see how this all shapes up. I know it's going to be spectacular.
Thank you.
I'm just thankful that you are here. I'm so thankful.
Yes. Any
last thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
To all of your loyal, loving listeners, just keep telling your stories. Keep writing your stories. Keep thinking about your stories, be they creative, fiction, or rooted in nonfiction and more about your life. We all have a story in us, several stories in us, and it's important that we never let them go and that we share them in any way that we're able. So keep telling your stories.
Mm. And with that, we will keep telling our stories. Thank you for listening and thank you for being here, Monica. This has been an episode of Critical Futures, the future of the Unmuseum.
Thank you for listening to the Critical Futures podcast. If you're feeling inspired and looking for more resources, please check out www.ihje.org/podcast for show notes and links to resources and to subscribe.